You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a program in Milwaukee that pairs adults with seniors to help them stay healthy and independent.
First, we're taking a look at the criminal justice system here in Wisconsin. In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court banned mandatory life sentences without parole for juveniles who had committed murder. As a result of that decision, there are about 68 inmates in Wisconsin who committed murder before turning 16 who are in a gray area. They're not likely to be paroled, but they don't technically fall under the Supreme Court ruling.
Kara Lombardo joins us now. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she's been following this story. Kara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, before we key in on these Wisconsin inmates, let's look at what the U.S. Supreme Court did. What did that decision mean?
Right. Well, in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed the life sentences without parole for juveniles. That's anybody under the age of 18. In 2016, they went back and said that decision should be retroactive, so therefore someone who had already received the life sentence without parole should now get a chance to see the parole board or have their sentences reexamined. One important thing about the ruling, though, was that it related to mandatory life sentences without parole. So that would be when it is required that if charged with this crime, you automatically get that life sentence. Here in Wisconsin, we don't even have that. So that's one aspect that doesn't apply to the 68 people we're looking at.
Right. And looking at those 68 now, they received life sentences for crimes committed as juveniles, right? But we don't have, as you say, that technical category of life, mandatory life without parole. But in effect, it sounds like they're very unlikely to be paroled.
That's right. Actually, on our list, they not only don't have mandatory life sentences, but they, many of them, all but three on the list I was looking at, will be eligible for parole or have already been eligible. But the issue is that parole here in Wisconsin has been slowing down. We've seen under Walker's administration fewer and fewer people being granted parole. So the question is, are these juveniles effectively serving life sentences without parole? And some of their lawyers are starting to ask that question.
And when at least some of these juveniles were sentenced, as I understand it, it was when a parole tended to happen more often. The odds of being paroled when you were eligible were much higher. So a court's understanding of that sentence might have assumed that they would be paroled someday. And then it changed.
That's right. One case I looked at, Deng Yang, who was 15 when his neighbor convinced him to shoot his wife for him in exchange for $25,000 and a truck was the promise. Obviously, he didn't follow through. Deng Yang, when he was sentenced, I spoke to his family. They distinctly remember getting the impression from the judge he was receiving a life sentence, but he would likely be released after 13 years, which was his first parole date. So judges were sentencing people under the expectation that most people were being paroled around a quarter of the way into their sentence. And now Deng is still obviously in prison. He's seen the parole board multiple times, but he keeps getting deferred. So he's not seeing what was expected.
Let's talk about some of the different reactions and approaches people are having. There are people who are calling for changes in juvenile justice in the United States, fewer juveniles being tried in adult courts, not having these really long-term sentences. What kind of arguments are they pointing to for people who have often committed, juveniles have often committed fairly heinous crimes?
Yeah, these crimes are absolutely horrible, every one of them. It was difficult to read about. So that is that's obvious. The research that some of the juvenile justice advocates, the Supreme Court, and even now lawmakers of all types are pointing to is the brain research. We know now it's fairly accepted, widely accepted, that the juvenile's brain, specifically the portion that controls impulse control, the portion that's able to stop and think, what are the consequences of this action? What are the positive consequences? What are the possible negative consequences? That is still being formed all the way into your 20s. And in fact, they also know that juveniles' brains tend to diminish the negative consequences and really focus in on the positive consequences. So for example, in the case of Deng Yang, being offered that large sum of money that was almost too big to fathom, that type of thing would have been enhanced in his brain, and he would have not thought through what is he actually doing quite as much.
So the idea being that someone who commits a heinous crime at age 13, 16, that neighborhood might not turn into an adult who's likely to repeat that crime.
That's the exact idea. And the other thing we know from the brain research is that the same development that's still going on is also makes them more capable of rehabilitation because they're more able to bring in new information. Their brain is still developing.
Talking to Kara Lombardo, she's been writing from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about life sentences for juvenile offenders in Wisconsin. Kara, you also talked to someone with an advocacy group for families of victims of crimes. What did you hear from them?
Yes, I spoke to Jody Robinson of the National Victims of Juvenile Murderers organization. She's the president of the organization, and she was describing how painful it is. She lost her brother to a juvenile in Michigan. She was describing the painful process of legal issues that continue on for if a sentence is reexamined each time that reopens the painful healing process that they had started to do. She mentioned that knowing exactly what will happen, for example, somebody getting a life sentence and knowing that they will be eligible for parole even, but knowing when that parole date will be with certainty allows people like her to get the closure they need. She said when the Supreme Court rulings happened, that opens up old wounds for these people. Then her group has about 400 members, and she said they feel similar in that way.
Speaking of families of victims, you also wrote about one of these 68 inmates in Wisconsin who was working to try to prevent other juveniles to prevent crimes. He was contacted by the father of his victim. Can you talk through that story?
Yeah, that was quite remarkable. Adam Purcell, he was living in Milwaukee. When he was a young teenager, he got involved with a gang. He was one of a few people involved in gunfire that killed a 18-year-old member of a rival gang. Since he got to prison, he had a few hard years in prison where he wasn't acting out. He had a total reformation and began writing down techniques for parents to use to tell if their children are becoming involved with a gang or at risk of becoming involved with a gang. He wrote now a 500-page book about how to recognize the signs. He's put together an iPhone app in which the parent can kind of take a quiz. Has your child mentioned this? Has your child been in these areas of Milwaukee or across the state? He identifies and then gives the parent back a likelihood that they're at risk for becoming involved with gangs and how to prevent that. So he's done a lot of that work. He was actually featured in a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article several years ago, and the father of the 18-year-old who was killed in that crossfire reached out to Adam Purcell and wrote him a letter and said, I just want you to know, I forgive you, I support what you're doing, keep doing it, that's really important work. And the father also wrote a letter on behalf of Adam to the parole commissioner saying, I have no problem if you want to release him. I really want him to be able to do this good work outside of prison.
Now, the status quo for these 68 people who were convicted as juveniles here in Wisconsin, they are in prison. They may be eligible for parole now. They may be someday. Odds are they won't get it given recent parole statistics. Is there an effort to change things in state law, in the way parole works, or is it case by case where people are going to try to take this precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court and try to apply it to this different situation?
That's a question I'm not able to answer. We really don't know. I think what we know now is we've seen many other states, I mentioned a few in my article, but many states are examining the parole process, both for juveniles and other people. And we know here in Wisconsin there has been a push in the legislature to raise the age at which someone can be convicted as an adult. So they're hoping to move 17-year-olds back to the juvenile court. The current proposal for that would not include violent crimes, but these types of law changes tend to happen in portions. So this could be the first step toward at least keeping more juveniles out of the adult system.
Kara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Kara Lombardo, reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked to us about her reporting on the legal gray area some Wisconsin youth are in after a Supreme Court ruling banned life without parole sentences for juvenile offenders.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Debbie Worster is having a ball at her new home in a retirement community. She's got a full calendar of activities, she's making new friends, and she's even competing in a Halloween costume contest in her homemade Minnie Mouse costume.
So do you want to tell me what you're wearing?
I'm Minnie Mouse.
I made the hat.
And the nose?
And this is a clown nose. See, you can sort of breathe with it.
You're so into this. How did you get interested in costumes?
Well, I think it was because of the kids. They'd say, I want to be such and such. And so I'd have to figure out, well, how am I going to do that? We weren't going to spend $40 or something at the store buying something. They're usually dumb and they don't fit right. And the kids over the years have said, well, I think you should have worked at a costume shop. I've made almost everything that I have, or I've bought it at rummage sales. I made this. I made that. I made this one. I've made almost everything.
I'm Deb Worster.
And we have the Halloween party today.
Hello, hello, hello!
Hello.
Hey.
Happy Halloween.
Yes.
Okay. We're going to start with the costume judging right away here.
Since it's a pizza party, I'm a piece of pizza. Well, I found some fabric that was perfect.
Like, yeah, it looks like pizza. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we moved in here early November. The kids were all gone, and it was time. It was time. We moved at the right time, and we're glad we did. It got too much to have to do the firewood every year and raking. It was way too much. And the two of us just looked at each other, and it was like, yeah, we got to get out of here. Now we look out the window and watch them plowing at 3 a.m. and never have to do anything. Everything was so well planned. These are the maps. There's a craft room, sewing room. There's all kinds of things. Fitness room. There's a music room. There's a stained glass lab thing. They have so many things going here. If you're bored, you know, you aren't going and doing things.
Okay, our mystery person is our best.
Yay!
That was really cute.
And then Debbie is number two with Minnie Mouse.
Good job.
This story was produced by Katie Clarkson. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And sticking with senior issues, a program in the Milwaukee area matches adults with seniors in an effort to help them maintain wellness and independence in their later years. Joining us now to tell us more about the program is George Hinton. He's CEO of the Community Relations Social Development Commission. George, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good to be on. It's good to be on.
Well, can you walk us through how your senior companion program works?
Sure. It's a program that was been put in place for over 50 years now. It was designed to provide companionship, just like it sounds, companionship to individuals who are in their senior year. It's seniors' providing companionship with four seniors and with seniors. It's providing an opportunity for volunteers to be friends with the volunteers, for the companions, to be able to be with them, to enjoy things like a cup of coffee, go to the movies, maybe to help them write letters to families, to help them deal with complicated paperwork, to listen to them, to go out and eat with them. It really is to help them have someone in their life during the time when many of their friends, natural or their friends that they may have grown up with and known through life, are leaving them or passing away. it's an opportunity for us to provide opportunities for people to stay home, but stay home in a way that would help them be social, not socially isolated, or have failure to thrive because they don't have someone in their life who would be their partner in many ways.
And I understand that last year these senior companions made thousands upon thousands of visits, over 12,000 visits to these senior clients. How does your matching process work to match these companions with these elderly people?
Well, we work with other agencies who have a really in-depth relationship with the client, who provides profile information about the client. What we do then is try to go out and find volunteers that meet certain criteria and get a profile for them. And then through that process, we match those volunteers up with the client so that there's some interest, or some areas of interest that are common between the two, and that we understand the needs of the client and also what that volunteer can bring to that client to help them with the things that they're looking for in their relationship.
And we've heard reports on how seniors can become depressed when they outlive their spouses, they outlive their friends. Is a program like this filling an emotional need for the companion and the client?
Yeah, one of my career is in healthcare. I was in healthcare for over 25 years, and one of my areas of responsibility was working with a geriatrics clinic. These are doctors who specialize in geriatric care. And one of the things they constantly reminded me is that keeping our seniors' minds and bodies and souls engaged and living was really something that would be good for their health. It keeps them from becoming depressed, withdrawn. It helps them from going into unnecessary declines in health. So these are really important services that need to be not only engaged with our population who are seniors, but also we need to grow them because, as you know, we have a growing amount of seniors beginning to hit our marketplace as we begin to see our baby boomers get to the age where they're going to be needing more and more services.
George, have you seen some concrete signs that this senior companion program is helping to perhaps delay assisted living for these seniors who are getting this companionship?
Yeah, like I said before, I've talked to a lot of geriatricians. They have told me there is research out there that lets us know that these things work and these are the types of activities that actually complement medical health. It also helps to reduce the cost of health care because people don't have to access health care as much if they're not as depressed and things like that. I think the expenses that we see for people who, for example, are in a nursing home can be as much as almost as high as $100,000 a year. But if we can keep people at home, it's much less, for example. Some of our senior companions right now, we have two of them who are over the age of 100, one who will be 100 this Christmas Eve. We have about 32 of our companions, not our companions, but our clients, are over 90. And so we're talking about folks who are could be using a lot of resources, that would be very expensive for them and their family. But we believe, and we show and have evidence from talking to their families and others, that we make a difference in their lives and helping them to stay engaged in the process of living their life in a normal way.
We're talking with George Hinton. He's CEO of the Community Relations Social Development Commission and serving Milwaukee County area. George, you've had this program for more than 50 years. Have you changed it over the decades in any way, or has it stayed pretty similar across the spectrum of years?
Well, I'm sure everything changes since I wasn't around for all the 50 years. I can't speak for exactly how it may have changed, but we're always surveying our clients and those individuals associated with our clients to see how we can improve our services and make them more meaningful for our clients. We're trying to always adapt to what is. like we know that, you know, social media and all those kinds of things are in play now. So we have to adapt to that with our seniors and help them engage in those kinds of communication activities that they may not have been comfortable with in the past. So we're always looking to tool up our volunteers as well as understand our clients and then make those trainings within our volunteer training sessions that would help us be good volunteers for our clients. So it's a moving target, but you know the basic program itself is companionship. Seniors being companions for other seniors. It benefits not only the senior who's the companion, but we have a lot of feedback from our volunteers that it benefits them too, because you know a lot of times when our seniors get to a certain age, they tend to feel like it's all over and there's no need. They don't have a purpose. Well, our seniors are so engaged when they're volunteers, it begins to build a new level of purpose that they do. And many of them do it, even though they get a small stipend, they do it because they want to volunteer.
And George, how do people get involved?
Well, all they have to do is call our office here at SDC, and we will help engage them in their neighborhood or whatever area that works for them. Our telephone number is 414-906-2700. All you have to ask for is our senior companion program. We will do everything we can to help work for that person as a volunteer or someone who may have a family member who's looking for a companion.
Thanks so much for joining us today, George.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's really important, so I appreciate the opportunity.
That was George Hinton, CEO of the Social Development Commission, and we've been talking about the Senior Companion Program.
With those elections just around the corner, a lot of political conversations have been swirling over who's going to be the next president and how much either candidate will win or lose by.
Presidential races are the contests that drive the most voters to the polls and even have a special system in place to help the election process of the president. It's called the Electoral College.
But why was the Electoral College created and why do we even have a president in our system of government in the first place? To answer these questions, we have to look to the founding of the United States and early American constitutional history.
And joining us to delve into these questions is historian Kenneth Davis. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
It is a great pleasure to be with you, although I'm sure that people heard the words Electoral College and their knees went weak.
Tuning out.
Well, it turns strong men weak and brings our greatest fears to the fore, because we think either that we're going to be quizzed like it's sixth grade civics class, or my goodness, the worst is that the Electoral College and won't line up with the popular vote and we'll have 2000 all over again.
Well, first, take us way back to the 1700s. The U.S. isn't the U.S. yet, but the founders are trying to figure out what this new potential democracy is going to look like. They're hammering it out. What conversations are they having about the government that they wanted to start?
Well, let's get our facts lined up here. 1776, we become a nation in July 4th of 1776. Actually, July 2nd, but that's another story. And so we become the United States of America in 1776, and for the next 11 years or so, the country is run under something called the Articles of Confederation, very weak system of national government where each of the 13 states had a single vote in Congress. So you had the arguments within each state delegation as to how they were going to vote, and then arguments in the whole Congress. So it was a poor way of getting things done. And in 1787, some of those same men and some different men go back to Philadelphia, sit in a locked room, closed windows, locked doors, and hammer out what became the United States Constitution. They resolve that all on September 17th, 1787, which is now marked as Constitution Day. And there's no question that there were a lot of arguments over the course of those months that they were locked in that fairly hot room. And part of the argument was clearly about what the president would be, and part of the argument was going to be about who would choose him, and then part of the argument was how the country would be divided up. And so these were all pressing issues because these men probably feared one thing more than anything else, and that would be one man with too much power. They did not want an elected monarch, in other words.
Right, Ken, and that idea of who is the person in this important position was a big deal. As you say, the one thing they knew was they didn't want a new king, but a lot of governments go without a president or without a powerful president, maybe having a prime minister instead. What were the arguments, pro and con, for this idea of this independent president not elected by the Congress itself?
Well, Alexander Hamilton had a word for it. It was vigor. They needed a man with vigor, and now we can think of, you know, George Bush mountain biking or Barack Obama playing basketball, but that's not the vigor they had in mind. They wanted someone who could respond quickly to a crisis in particular, and also someone who could speak with a single voice when it came to negotiating treaties or dealing with other nations. There were too many situations where the nation needed to respond quickly to pressing issues, that it shouldn't be left to Congress to dither for weeks or months to come up with the appropriate response. So the idea of a powerful executive was there from the beginning, and they did not want the parliamentary system where the leader of a party was going to be that leading figure in the government. They thought that led to too much cabal or politicking. And these were men who actually opposed the very idea of parties or what they would have called factions. So they wanted the president not to be chosen by the legislature, which is essentially what a parliament does, but still have the strength, the vigor, the executive ability to respond quickly. And what would that mean in specifics? Well, giving him the power to command the army. And that really gave them the willies, the notion of one man in charge of an army. These were people who understood the history of republics going back to ancient Rome. They knew that generals, a strong man with an army, would actually be the end of a republic if they weren't careful.
We're talking with Ken Davis, the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. Now, Ken, fast forward to the Electoral College. How was it established?
Well, the other big argument besides what powers to actually give the president was the argument over who would choose him. They did not want, as I just mentioned, a parliamentary system where the leader of a party would essentially be the leader of the government. On the other hand, these were men who feared too much democracy. They thought democracy was basically one step removed from mob rule. They were afraid that certainly in a nation that was very, very divided and linked by not much in the way of communications, how would people in Massachusetts know somebody from Georgia or South Carolina to make a considered judgment about them? How were people to even understand what the issues are, because most people weren't educated? There wasn't a great deal of public education, and literacy was low. So they didn't really trust the people, in the sense that we like to think of these as men as champions of democracy, but that's why they wanted to leave the decision up to somebody else besides the people or the legislature. And so this compromise of electors, each state being given a number of electors equal to their representation in Congress, seems to make perfect sense. And these electors presumably would have the discernment, the judgment, the ability to weigh the issues and make more considered decisions. How the electors would be chosen was going to be left up to the individual states. There was really one big issue in all of this that underscored the whole thing, however, and that was who was going to be counted in the census for determining how many electors or congressmen each state would have. And the big issue, obviously, was that there were about a million people in 1790 who wouldn't vote, but certainly the slaveholding states wanted to count them. Of course, I'm talking about enslaved people. And this was the last of the compromises that was reached in the Constitutional Convention, that enslaved people would be counted for the purpose of representation in Congress and electors, but only as 3/5 of a person. We look back at that and we think of it as somewhat horrifying, but this was the essence of what slave power was going to mean for a very, very long time, and certainly one of the reasons why five of the first seven presidents were going to be slaveholders. And this is a subject I talk about in a new book, which is called In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives.
And Ken, I want to ask about the role of the elector here. If I'm an elector in, say, 1800s election or something like that, how much of a free agent am I? How much is it expected that I'm going to go along with what the voters in my state said versus my own, I think you use the word, discernment about the candidates?
Well, it's interesting because they certainly the men who framed the Constitution and certainly men like Washington and even Madison to some degree were opposed to the idea of parties. They worried about it. Madison writes against party or faction, as he describes it, in the Federalist Papers, these essays which are written in essence to argue in favor of ratification of the Constitution. So they were going to expect that these electors would be free agents for the most part and make the best decisions. Should point out, though, that there was one more piece of this that's very important before we get too far into how the electors vote, which is that the Constitution also created the kind of safety valve that if the electors did not reach a majority decision, then the vote would go to the House of Representatives. You can be cynical and say these men who are creating this understood that this, or thought at least, this was where elections were going to be ending up in the end. They knew, for instance, that George Washington was going to be the first president. There was no question about it. He was sitting there presiding over the Constitutional Convention as they're discussing the presidency, and everybody must have been casting sidelong glances at Washington because they knew as they were talking about this office that they were talking about the man who was sitting there. Washington is pretty much silent throughout most of this. Anything that he said would have been unofficial and maybe said in the evening over a glass of port, not officially recorded in the proceedings. So Washington was by far the unquestioned the first person. Franklin says, we know the first man at the helm will be a good one, but after that we'll be on our way to a monarchy perhaps. So they were building in this kind of safety valve that the legislature or Congress would ultimately decide who the president would be. And in fact, that's what happens in the first really contested election in 1800. It's an election which proves also that the mechanism they had created didn't work too well, because two men of essentially the same party, Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, finish in a tie. And John Adams finishes third. He's the sitting president. So the very first contested election, in fact, goes to the House of Representatives, and it takes a very, very long time for them to come to a decision. And people were starting to worry that the country might be on a verge of a rebellion or a revolution right there.
We're talking to historian Ken Davis about the American political system, namely why the U.S. has an electoral college and why we have a president. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned, and he has a new book out, In the Shadow of Liberty.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of the American political system, the rise of the Electoral College? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Would we be better off these days without an Electoral College?
We're continuing our conversation about the formation of the American political system in the early days of its founding, namely why we have the Electoral College and why we have a president.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the early political days of our country, how things got worked out in the Constitution? What do you want to know about the Electoral College? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Historian Ken Davis stays with us. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. Let's go to our caller, Robert in Neenah. Hi, Robert.
Hey.
What do you have to say?
Well, I got a lot to say about this election that's going on. It's been kind of crazy, but my question to Ken is, who are these people who are the Electoral College, and how do we vote for them? Or are they just people that are randomly picked like jury duty people? I go to school for political science and government, and someday, soon, I'd like to be a politician, and I'd like to make this world a better place. And I'm wondering, is it something that a new person could start out in, being an Electoral College voter for a certain party? Or is it something that you're picked by, like, the state?
It's a very good question. There's such a mystery to it. And first of all, the word Electoral College, by the way, nowhere appears in the Constitution. It was a phrase that grew over time. There is legislation that refers to the Electoral College now, but it's not actually a constitutional term. The word electors is used. Nowadays, most electors are people who are appointed by the parties. And in some states, in fact, you go and you, when you cast your ballot, you may be actually seeing the names of the electors as opposed to the candidate. Usually it's underneath the candidate name, but you're voting in most states for a slate of electors. Those people are appointed. They cannot be elected officials, so usually they're party functionaries, people who have been, you know, working, volunteering, perhaps working for the party, and they are named by the parties in each state that are on the ballot. The always interesting question is, are they bound to vote for the candidate that's been chosen in that state? And that's really left up to the states, but without anything but a handful of exceptions, electors have always pretty much stayed the course and chosen the candidate for whom the state has gone in the election itself, in the popular election. Of course, we still have a situation, as we did in 2000, where the popular vote can go one way and the electoral vote can go the other.
Robert, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jerry in Mauston. Jerry, hi. Oh, and we just lost Jerry. I've got a quick summary of his question. He was asking if, say, a state like Wisconsin, say, Donald Trump won more of the popular vote, is there a way that Hillary Clinton, say, could end up with the electors casting ballots for her?
Again, each state has its own rules as to how strictly binding the electors are to the state's vote, and I don't know Wisconsin's rules, for instance, but it's unlikely, but not impossible, for instance, that a faithless elector, as they are sometimes called, could actually cast a vote for a different candidate than the state had elected. It's certainly never happened in a way that affected the outcome of a state. Usually it's been more of a protest vote. And again, each state has its own rules, and I can't cite Wisconsin.
Ken, talk a little bit about third parties that have not fared well in the Electoral College system. Why is that?
Well, because there is an Electoral College system, and it's weighted so heavily against a third party because you have to win states and not just votes. It's very, very difficult for a third party to create the organization to actually, first of all, get on the ballot in all 50 states. It's a high hurdle in many states to get on the ballot. So the organization and the financing that's required to do that is substantial. there have been truly only a handful of third parties that have had a meaningful impact on elections in our history, and some of them quite significant. Perhaps the most famous, 1912, the Republican Party split into two parties. The sitting president was Taft, and he was the official Republican Party nominee. But there was another guy named Theodore Roosevelt, the former president. He was not happy with Taft. He then decides to run as a progressive or bull moose, and Woodrow Wilson is the Democratic candidate. And essentially, Roosevelt and Taft then split the Republican vote and give the election to Woodrow Wilson in 1912. It was one of the most extraordinary elections in our history. In more recent times, very notable examples of third parties having an impact would be Ross Perot back in 1992 with the Reform Party, perhaps influencing the outcome of that election by drawing what might have been Republican votes away from George Bush and giving the election to Bill Clinton. And certainly in 2000, a great many people still believe that Ralph Nader's Green Party in several states tipped the balance away from Al Gore, certainly in Florida, but in other states like New Hampshire, where Ralph Nader and the Green Party did well enough to draw votes away from Al Gore and cost him the election.
Well, Ken, I want to bring things home with a hypothetical case where a third party could have a big impact. There's this candidate running strong in Utah, Evan McMullen. Some polls have put him on top. He could come away with electoral votes, which none of those people you talked about ended up with. So if there's a case where it's Trump in the 260s, Clinton in 260s, neither gets a majority, McMullen with Utah's electoral votes, then it goes to the House of Representatives and it's all equal between the three of them, right, before the House of Representatives.
That's correct. Back in 1828, there were five candidates running nationally, and none of them won a majority in the Electoral College. Then candidate Andrew Jackson actually had the most popular votes, but John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, and Henry Clay cut a deal, and Clay gave his support to John Quincy Adams, and the House of Representatives chose John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson immediately claimed this was a corrupt bargain, and the race for 1832 was on. It was one of the most mean-spirited, nasty elections in American history, and created a really difficult governing period for John Quincy Adams, and one of the reasons that he was a one-term president. So it certainly happens that this idea of a non-majority in the Electoral College going to the House of Representatives, it certainly could happen. It seems unlikely in this case. Much more recently.
Oop, and Ken, I'm going to have to jump in. We're all out of time. Thanks to Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History.